Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
The contemplation of mortality is deeply spiritual and can create genuine transformation if it leads you to the realization that you are not this body. You are that which is eternal. You are the essence of love itself, and it cannot be touched by anything in this world.
Love does not know death. Dr. Adam Rizvi, my guest. And if you ever had a question about what it would be like on the front line when people are transitioning, Adam Rizvi, doctor, is familiar with that. And I guess maybe death wish as a child, imagining that you were dead, then that was a pastime. That got my attention. So why don't you give us a background to start out with?
That's a funny pastime, huh? Well, it started off with a very multicultural background. My father was born and raised in Pakistan, a Muslim family. Moved to the States to support his family. My mom raised in a pretty deeply religious Roman Catholic household in France, actually in Brittany or Normandy. And she ended up moving to the States after getting married with my dad. And it's amazing, they fell in love with each other from two very different backgrounds. But growing up, I essentially was faced with this cognitive dissonance of, okay, well, clearly the two traditions are very different from each other, but there's also points in common. And so naturally I gravitated towards, okay, what is in common to both? And fundamentally they shared the same idea of a creator, of a God. But even deeper still, the idea of being kind and loving and supportive and helpful to your family and to those around you, contributing to society, that kind of thing. But it sort of lit a fire in me of wanting to explore more. And that got me interested in comparative religion in college. It essentially kicked off my spiritual journey well before medical school. And eventually, with my dad's encouragement, I went into medical school, I got my MD, and I started practicing. But that background, that spiritual background, the existential searching never left. In fact, it just kept deepening and deepening. And I had a rich spiritual practice all throughout medical school and into residency and then fellowship and then into being a practicing physician. And it colored every aspect of my life, but most importantly, my career as a physician. I sort of was exploring spiritual growth through these interactions I was having with my patients and their family members. The most rich interactions I've ever had in my whole life has been at the deathbed of patients. Something happens, Wendy. Something happens to families and people when they legitimately see that death is at their doorstep. The pretense falls away. The BS falls away. People suddenly get super real about what matters in their life, what they care about, who they love. They speak their mind. All of the buried hurt and grievances comes right up to the surface. And having been in the spiritual path for so long leading up to this, I recognized that pattern. I said, oh, this is huge. This is huge. When that kind of unconscious material that needs to be healed rises to the surface, we need to take advantage of that, because it's all about, am I growing spiritually? Am I awakening? Am I evolving as a spiritual being? And I could see this happen right in front of my eyes with these families. I could see families embrace it, maybe consciously or unconsciously, embrace it as an opportunity for growth and love and healing. And I saw other families that were completely lost to the opportunity and just deepened in their suffering and their judgment against one another and attack. And it's just terrible to see. And so essentially I started to think, well, let me just capture what some families do that brings about healing and what some families don't. And it was just purely observational and taking it into context with my spiritual growth and awakening, and just capture it in the book. And so that's why the book has a bunch of stories, but all those stories are steeped in my personal growth and my spiritual growth and what I took from these lessons.
I like the way you've laid it out, and you really have included some beautiful transition stories. But let's go back to you for a bit, because when you were talking about spending time with each of your grandmas, the one in France, I believe, that the lamb stew, lamb, the dinner. Okay, that was like a magic moment. But the memory also of Pakistan and the food being cooked there and the meat sliced on the floor and the tiles and you have the ambiance, the setting for both of those settings. But the common factor between both of those grandmas, at the end of life, there was the possibility of hell. And I think that scared you straight. I think
yes,
I think that's why you went to bed and envisioned, okay, I'm dead now, and what am I going to do? Okay, now I'm going to do that. I just thought of all the things
right.
A child at 8 years old is contemplating, that is the last one. I used to think about fairies and gnomes and, all sorts of things like that. And here you were contemplating your exit. But they weren't being mean. They were just trying to help you go the right direction, because you don't want to go here. And so what did that do as you began to search and find different ways and different beliefs? Because it did send you on it. You were basically looking under every rock and exploring every nook and cranny. What else is here besides hell?
Yes. So just for listeners, just to create some context. Every summer, and I'm so grateful for my parents for this. I only later on as an adult realized how truly special my childhood was. But my parents wanted me to have a really thorough understanding of my cultural heritage. And so as kids, you get summer off, summer vacation. I wish that was still the case for adulthood, but it's not. But we had summers off. So, for those 2 to 3 months that we had off, my sister and I, we would either go to Pakistan or France. And so it would alternate. One summer it would be Pakistan with my grandparents in Karachi, which is south of Pakistan, or the other summer would be with my grandparents in Normandy, in France, in a city called Rennes, actually, which is northwest of France. And, when you're 7 or 8, your grandparents are, I love them dearly. They were my heart and soul. There's a special love there with grandparents, assuming that you have a loving family, and not everyone does.
Yeah.
But my grandparents truly did. Both grandparents, both sets in Pakistan and in France, they genuinely loved my sister and I, and they did everything they could to support us. And part of that was making sure we were prepared spiritually. Both of sets of grandparents were deeply religious within their respective traditions. In Pakistan, they were staunch Muslims following Islam, and Roman Catholics in France, and they each wanted us to know how to prepare for the hereafter. And I don't blame them, because they genuinely meant well for us. Like any good religious grandparent, you want your grandchildren to have the best that they can offer. So one summer, while I was with my French grandmother, they had met. After my parents got married, both families met each other, spent some time with each other, and they were cordial and friendly and everything. They had met each other. So here I am with my grandma in France, and she said, I love your Pakistani family. It's just too bad they're going to hell. And I was just distraught. I said, wait, what? Why are they going, that's not fair, because they didn't know how lovely they were. And I can't for the life of me imagine why anyone so kind could deserve hell. It just didn't compute for me. And so I was just sort of dumbstruck and thought, I mean, I briefly thought, okay, do I need to teach them about Jesus and the Bible? Like, is this now my mission? But, you know, I've kind of dropped that, and just let it brew in the recesses of my mind until I heard the exact same phrase, nearly identical, from my Pakistani grandmother while we were cooking one day. And she said, I really enjoyed meeting many years ago your French family. It's just too bad they're going to hell. Now, what do you do with that as a 7-year-old or 8-year-old?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was when I was like, oh my gosh, hearing that. And, you know, the twinned version of that. And then here's this child who's going, how many ways do I figure out how to make this work? Because you were getting mixed messages from both sides, not in a negative way, in a positive, trying to help you. And, you know, so that was clear. That was clear. But it was, I'm sure, incredibly confusing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, one, it's like, okay, if it's true, and obviously you want to believe your grandparents, they've never lied to me in the past. Why would they lie now? But clearly something's not working. So does that mean I need to go to France and tell them, hey, you know, you guys need to be good Muslims and read the Quran? Mm-hmm. Obviously not. And then I started thinking, well, what do I need to do? Do I need to pray the rosary and the tasbih, which is the Muslim version of that? Do I need to memorize the Quran and the Bible? I was just lost. I think there's a voice in me, a part of me inside that knew maybe preconceptually, because I was maybe too young to really process this mentally, but as a part of me that knew there has to be a truth that lovingly welcomes all human beings, all of life. It just does not make sense that a whole swath of people would experience an eternity in some place called hell for not believing in something that they otherwise had no exposure to. And then I started questioning about, I remember one of my earlier thoughts was, what about those tribes in the Amazon that have never seen another human being? They've never even heard of Jesus Christ or the Bible. They've never heard of the Prophet Muhammad. Like, they are totally unaware of that. When they die, what happens to them? You know, and my young mind was thinking, like, there's a deep level of unfairness here, but I know the universe isn't unfair. It can't be. It can't. There's got to be an underlying truth that explains all this. And that was my only impetus for the search.
I think you had an amazing insight, an amazing awareness that set you on this path, because you wouldn't be sitting beside the bed of people who are transitioning without the kind of knowledge, the kind of empathy, the sincere caring that you exhibit. And I know A Course in Miracles has made a very profound emphasis on you. I remember when I was reading it back in the early 90s that my thing was, I chose one, and it was, I am open to receive miracles. That was my favorite, and it still is. So when I saw that you were, you know, that this was a very powerful emphasis for you and the way that you see people, because it is, it's everyone is accepted. There's no differentiation. Everything is a part of this. And I thought, wow. Because I think you had to run that whole spectrum to see that no matter what religion, no matter what background you have as a spiritual training, we're all one in the very fact that we are human beings here at the same time, in the same place, trying to find our way, however that manifests. I love your grandparents. I love the fact that they gave you those challenges. Because I think, you know, your homework, you excelled. And you just, you know, I was thinking the same thing when I was a kid. You know, what happens to all the South American natives who don't have a church? You know, where are they going? Why, you know, what happened? And I think those are questions that when you get to the end point of your life and you've had some kind of a diagnosis that is stage 4, and everybody's wondering, well, what is next? You're there to say you'll be okay. And you demonstrate that. There's some incredibly powerful transitions. And one was a man who, he was just trying to get his kids there. And they'd been estranged, and he was hoping that they were there.
Yeah, I remember that. That was Robert. Really briefly, Wendy, if I could, there's something else I wanted to say. There's this quote in the tail end of A Course in Miracles that says a universal theology is impossible, but a universal experience is not only possible, but necessary. When I read that, I was like, yes, yes, it's about a universal experience. As soon as we put words to it, as soon as we filter the experience with cultural values, societal norms, our religious beliefs, then the experience takes on a different flavor. We can feel, someone could feel this immense, inexplicable peace and love just wash over them. And a Christian would say, I've experienced revelation. A Muslim would say, I've experienced, or a Sufi might say, I've experienced fana, which is like the annihilation of the ego. Like there's so many ways that culture and religion will shape how an experience is expressed in word. But I just felt so drawn to that way of saying, yes, a universal experience. And fundamentally, where I landed on, and you mentioned A Course in Miracles, really, that's just one form of many, many ways of speaking about truth. The book was not intended to proselytize A Course in Miracles, but really speak to this universal experience of love. There is one way of looking at others in the world that genuinely is healing, and it's this, that everyone is wholly deserving of love. I really enjoyed Mother Teresa, or Teresa of Calcutta, as she's known elsewhere. She has this really interesting philosophy. She basically said everyone, regardless of whether they're being unreasonable or selfish, deserves to be loved unconditionally. She didn't care whether the people she was caring for were Catholics or not, or Christians, or believed in Jesus. She saw them as equally deserving of love. That, for me, overcomes all religious boundaries. If you can look at another person, no matter how ugly their behavior is, or quote unquote wrong, if you can see at the core of their being, they equally deserve to be loved. Now, how that love gets expressed is different. Like, I'm not condoning negative behavior, you know, murderers and people doing terrible things. Sometimes the way we express love is to limit that kind of destructive behavior, and laws apply here. But on the inside, if we can look at them and say they are deserving of love, there's so much healing that happens there. So much healing.
I think there's an acceptance that comes with that.
Yeah.
There's a vulnerability, the acceptance, and you drop all of the facade of, I am this, I am that, you know, the mask that comes with, I have to be a certain way, I have to be seen a certain way. It's like, okay, I'm done with that. It's, and especially if you're facing death, then all of those things just drop away. You can't hold them up anymore. So let's get back into Robert. Robert, your experience with him.
So many interesting things happened with this one gentleman. So he had a condition called COPD. It stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and it was end stage. We knew that when he got to us. It's a fairly common thing for people to come to the ICU with, where they have a pulmonary disease, that meaning their lungs are affected and they cannot breathe anymore. And it's an interesting thing. Yes, there is such a thing as lung transplants, but it's rare, and you need to meet certain criteria. So often people with end-stage lung disease, they come to the ICU and to die, essentially. And this was Robert's case. He had end-stage COPD. While he was still able to hold a conversation, he was telling me about his son, who he was estranged with, and his children as well, and really wanting to talk to his son before he goes. He had a sense that he may not make it. Oh gosh, there's so many things I want to say about this. Well, first of all, let me just say, if a patient tells you, I'm worried I may not make it, it doesn't do much to say, oh, stop talking negatively, and then dismiss them. As a family member, or even as a nurse or a physician, we should honor the fact that they are facing the possibility of mortality. And we can do that in a way that doesn't tell them, yes, it's going to happen, yes, you're going to die. No, you can just be with them and say, yes, it can be scary to look at death. And that's a very human thing to do. So with Robert, this beautiful, wonderful nurse and I were basically facing death together with him. And we tried to go out of our way to get a hold of his son. For a while, we just could not get a hold of him. But one of our, I don't exactly know now how it happened, but I believe one of our social workers was able to find his number on Facebook or something. We did some solid detective work, found him, reached out. Now, by the time we reached out to him, Robert couldn't talk anymore. He was on a face mask and had slipped into a coma from hypoxia. Robert, I wasn't able to interact with him anymore, but I felt connected with him. Something special that happens when you have these really deep conversations with your patients over several days, you bond with them. They bond with you. You feel for them. They become not members of your family, but there's a certain emotional intimacy that happens over several days when you face death together. And that I felt that connection with Robert. I felt his need and desire to just have his son, to know that his son's okay and have his son visit him. The day of his death, we had heard that his son, that we got a hold of his son and his son was flying in to see him and was aware that his father was going to die. I remember meditating or closing my eyes in the physician's office, which I do sometimes, thinking well of Robert, praying for him. And I remember feeling this sense of doubt creep up inside of me. And I felt like, am I doing everything I can for Robert? Did I miss something as a physician? And I don't think there's a physician out there that hasn't doubted themselves. I think we all do that in our jobs to some degree. And it was just this insecurity of, if he dies, will it have been my fault? And it's something I have to deal with every day when a patient of mine dies in the ICU. It's tough. And it's not unique to me. Hundreds of thousands of ICU doctors are probably experiencing some form of this. All we have to do is just keep doing the best we can with what we know and what our training has allowed us to do, and let the chips fall where they may. For Robert, I was internally sort of meditating on that self-doubt, and I could see that fear, and I just sort of turned and faced it, and I said, "No, you are wholly unreal. This doubt is unreal. I will not feed into it. I know my self-worth, and I know that I'm doing the best that I can." And it's almost like in a dream where you have a monster chasing you. At some point, you make a choice to just stop running. You turn around and you face the monster, and you realize it never was really that scary. Or maybe even in the dream, the monster vanishes because the running away kept it alive. In the book, I talk about the importance of looking within, looking at that darkness. It's the running away from darkness that makes it real. But if you look right at it, you realize it was just smoke and mirrors to begin with. So I did that. That self-doubt vanished. And I could see, it's funny, I could see this brilliant light that I was. And for some reason, because I was thinking about Robert, I immediately connected that to Robert. And I thought, that's Robert's light too. We share that light. We share that oneness. We share the innocence of having done the best that we could with what we knew. I'm sure Robert did the best he could as a father with what he knew and how he was raised. I don't know why he was estranged from his son. I don't know anything about the details, but I do know that we all are fighting a hard battle, so we should be kind to ourselves and to others. So I saw that light that Robert and I shared, and I just sort of rested there for a while. And I rested knowing that at the core of our being, we are one. At the core of our being, there's a shared innocence. And it's just such a feeling of release and peace in doing that. Now, the wild thing, and this has happened so many times, the wild thing is when I did that, as I was resting in that light, I got a phone call from the nurse saying that Robert just flatlined. And this has happened so often where I meditate, I'm thinking about the patient, and they pass. And I'm not saying this to say, hey, I caused it, but that I feel like we are connected with each other more than we realize. There's a shared unity. Our minds are connected, I truly believe. And there's something that happened between Robert and I where, I don't know, his feeling like he could transition at that point. I honestly don't know why it happened, but I don't believe in coincidences.
Yeah.
So suffice it to say, I got that call. I went over, I held his hand. The nurse offered a beautiful, beautiful prayer. And we just sat there. And I leaned in and I told Robert, like, your son is on his way. He was still, his heart rate had slowed down, and it was basically non-compatible with life, but I could still hear a heartbeat. He was in that sort of liminal zone of just making his transition. And I held his hand and I said, your son knows you're here. He's on his way. I spoke to him on the phone, which I had, and he is doing just fine. He's happy. He's married. His finances are all right. And he loves you very much. And he told us to tell you that. And it's like, I know he heard me. I can't prove that to you, but I felt it. And I could see this expression on his face, acknowledging what he heard. And I, the nurse was right there, and she saw it too. Like, there was definitely a change in his facial expression after I shared that with him.
Absolutely.
And then moments later, he passed away.
That moment when there's that in between, that liminal state, as you're saying, you know, that they're not quite out. There's that buoyancy that when you're praying for somebody, you're also elevating. That's a juice to give somebody that extra boost to make that transition. And those are my experiences and my beliefs, because it's unique. Okay, every death is unique, and each person experiences something different. I love what you've talked about in terms of your own sense of awareness of the other people as they're transitioning. It's such a special calling to be able to be there and be present. And even though you're doubting yourself that maybe you could have done something, and what would have happened if you had done something, I think right place, right time, things happen for a reason. And when you were able to tell him, he knew. The studies they've done with coma patients saying that no matter what the body is doing, they are still cognizant of things that are happening in the room. That's powerful. And I think we don't know enough about that to be able to put it on everybody. But I do think there's more going on that we need to learn with coma patients to be able to help assist them when they come out, because that's a real difficult process. So knowing that he was experiencing and exhibiting some kind of interaction because of what you said is powerful.
Yeah. You know, there's a very well-known book in the Tibetan tradition. It's called the Tibetan Book of the Dying. It's a whole series of practices and prayers explicitly to help a being, a mind, a human who's actively undergoing the death of the body, to help them make the transition, remind them of what they're seeing and what they're feeling, and that this transition is them moving on from the physical to the non-physical, because so much happens, I can imagine, in that transition. But for a mind that is conscious and aware as that transition happens, what a gift. And it's not just a Tibetan tradition. There's many traditions that have that sort of guided prayer for a soul as it makes its transition. One other thing that you said that I wanted to highlight is, I think we undervalue the presence of people at the bedside of someone dying. Even if we don't utter a word, holding an atmosphere of genuine positivity, a desire for freedom for the person who's dying, love, just holding love in your heart, there's something. And I'm not an expert in this. There's something on an energetic level, on a soul level, that I think we can feel when we're dying. And if just on a practical level, imagine you're dying and you're surrounded by people that are angry at each other, that are grieving, that are yelling and blaming others for your death, versus being in a bed surrounded by people who not only love you, but are giving you the freedom to go and make your transition. That's a whole different atmosphere to die inside of. And I think that's one of the messages I was hoping to convey, is you have more power and impact than you realize, whether you're a healthcare provider, a nurse, a physician, or a family member who's sitting at the bedside of your spouse or your husband or your parent. Like, your state of being, your emotional and mental state of being, has a huge impact on the person who's making their transition.
In the book, you include exercises in different chapters that address not only what the person who may be transitioning, dying, is going through and learning how to let go and release, but while you're still alive, looking at the things that may be holding you back in your own mindset, your own belief system, your own challenges. That's incredibly helpful. Chapter 6, Waking Up in the Dream, talking about in the dream, sometimes you don't know that you're dreaming. It feels so real. And if you've done lucid dreaming or out-of-body states, that kind of thing, all of these stages are reality. And what we do when we buy into a certain reality, like death being a bad, fearful, awful hell scenario, we imprint and we build the scenario that makes that real. Addressing those kinds of things, what kind of beliefs do I have about this and about what will happen to other people? And we can shift it right now and change that kind of reality, especially when you're trying to be present for someone who is at stage 4. You're offering people tools in addition to understanding that love does not know death. When people drop everything, it's that love that remains. And whether it's for a person, for a place, for an animal, for a situation, that love is the power that fuels everything.
Wow, Wendy, you got it. You totally got it. You got the book and you got the message. It's very touching to hear you share that. It's so true. Again, maybe it's morbid for a teenager to think about this, but there's something, not just a teenager, but just there's something powerful at any stage in your life in contemplating mortality, because that thing that I notice happens in the ICU room where I deliver this news to a family or a patient that unfortunately they have a condition that is terminal and they're probably going to pass away in a couple of days or weeks. There's a transformation that happens in the psyche of everyone that gets that kind of news. They get real. They become authentic. That's the biggest opportunity. There's a huge opportunity for growth. And so the message is, you don't need to wait till a doctor tells you that. You don't need to wait till you're given a terminal diagnosis. You can get to that place of authenticity right now. Ask yourself what really matters in your life. Is it the hustle culture? Is it making money? Is it having a bigger house and nicer car and the relationship that you want? And, you know, it's not. I've been at the bedside of many patients who, you know, they give me their deathbed confessionals. They never talk about the achievements of their life, the financial successes, as the things that they are most proud about. The things that they say are things like, I'm glad I was able to go to my children's rehearsal, to their soccer games. I'm glad I was able to spend most of my dinners with my wife before she passed away. Like, those, it's the moments where we express and receive love that we remember. Those are the moments that carry us forward that we're most proud of. And if there's something holding us back, if there's a grievance, if there's a pain, some regret of actions that we did to others or that others have done to us, we don't need to wait till we're facing death to heal that. That's probably the biggest message that I care to offer, is you don't need to wait till a doctor is telling you that you're about to die. You can do that healing work now, today.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses, plus free delivery when you add a base. Ends Monday. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number. To a good life's sleep.
The other thing you draw attention to in the book is your own ability to intuit, to be in conscious awareness with someone who is no longer in a physical body. And one of those, that example, is with a man who comes in from a car accident. There apparently was a pretty horrific accident. The other people may have died on the scene or on the way to the hospital. This one made it. And you're there in the room and you sense him beside you. Can you share that?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Wendy. It's so cool to have you bring up the stories. I really appreciate that you read it in depth. This young gentleman, well, let me just say, first of all, I have no training in anything to do with the paranormal and extrasensory perception. I just wrote down what I experienced. I kind of wish I had something more formal. I probably would have experienced more, but what I experienced was just what occurred to me, and I wrote it down as it happened. For this particular case, what happened was, I think he was in his early 20s. There was a massive multi-car pileup. Paramedics brought him in. I think he was the only one that had survived that far, and he was in very rough shape. It's so interesting to see the body broken in such a bloody way, where there are massive gashes, blood is just pouring on the floor. And I don't mean to scare away listeners, but there's something that happens when you see that and you're like, oh my gosh, it really is just flesh and bones with ligaments holding everything together. And when you see it like that, or when I see a body like that, my gut feeling is there is no way that is the only thing that we are. There is no way that this meat suit is the beginning and end of who we are as beings. Like that, it's just incomprehensible to me that most of our Western science is predicated on the belief that we are these bodies and that's it, and there's nothing more to us. There's no way that that can be the case. So this young kid comes in. The paramedic is straddled on top of him doing chest compressions. He comes in the trauma bay. Multiple nurses are putting IV lines in him. A respiratory therapist is working on getting a breathing tube in, connecting him to a ventilator. And his heart stops. And I'm in the ED at the time. I come into the trauma bay. The ED physician and I basically start running a code. Running a code means a code blue is when your heart stops. And to run a code means you stand at the foot of the bed and you orchestrate the resuscitative efforts. So my job was to hold the big picture of what was happening and what needs to happen. And I designate roles. So this nurse is giving meds. Then this nurse is establishing IV access. And this therapist, respiratory therapist, is taking care of the airway. Everyone has their role. And when I want, let's say calcium chloride or epinephrine to be given, I tell this one nurse to give it. And then she offers closed loop communication, says, okay, epinephrine given, and we move on. So we are working like a team, just going at it, pushing medications, doing electric shocks, going through a very structured approach to resuscitating this young man. And the whole thing lasts almost an hour. Because when someone's young, we really want to go for it, because the body, when it's young, is really resilient. Now, about 30 or 40 minutes into this code, I feel someone standing next to me. And the ED physician had stepped away and because he was busy and said, okay, you got it? You want to run the code? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll run it. And I turned to my right, wondering, like, was it the ED physician who came back to check up on things? But I didn't see anyone there. But what I saw was this faint outline of a figure sort of above me and to the right. And my gut feeling, my intuition was, this is the kid. This is the boy who's in front of me, and he's right here next to me. And the odd thing is, I could hear him. It's sort of like I could hear a voice in my head, not mine, but someone else's. And it's funny, like, I felt this intuitive sense, like, I am hearing this boy's voice. That's the knowing that came inside of me. And the question he asked was, is that me? And he wasn't worried. He was very calm, almost amused, and said, is that me? And I looked at the body and I could feel like he was seeing what I was seeing. And I said, well, that's your body, but that's not you. And he kind of felt like he was nodding and just observing. And then something interesting happened. I was looking at his body And it felt like I was looking at a movie screen, like I was just watching a display of light and shadow being projected on a movie screen. And I felt like I could fall through it to what was underneath or behind the screen. It's like I moved through a veil where now I wasn't seeing the body anymore, but I was seeing this sort of shimmering light, and it felt like, oh, I'm looking at his soul. And I don't like that word very much because it's misconstrued and it has so many different meanings. But I felt like this is the light of who he is underneath the body. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, wow. And then what happened is that shimmering light kind of felt like the surface of a huge ocean. And I felt like I dived even deeper and went through that. It's almost like the shimmering was the surface of a lake, like the shimmering of ripples on a water surface. And I kind of dived through that. And then I felt like I plunged into a vast ocean of light. It's like I fell through into the Pacific Ocean and suddenly grasped the immense magnitude of this body of water. I could barely fathom how wide and long it was. It just kept going and going and going. And my intuition was, oh, that's us. That is who we are. That's the core essence of all beings, all humans. That is this boy and me at the core of our very being. And I felt like he was walking with me through that vision, and he was seeing what I was seeing. And I remember talking to him, and I said, that's who we are. That singular, endless, vast ocean of light. That's who we are. And I could feel his acknowledgement. For a moment, we were both staring at this light together. And then, without any warning, he just vanished. Poof. It just disappeared. And I felt like, okay, that was it. He went. That was his transition. And at that point, it had been 55 minutes, something like that. And his heart rate before it had been ventricular fibrillation, VFib, coarse VFib, fine VFib. And then every time we paused for a pulse check, it was just flatline zero. And at that point, at 55 minutes, roughly, we decided to call it. The ED physician had come back and there was no way we can retrieve him. So we called it. We had a moment of silence. And it's funny because I knew he had already made his transition just moments ago. And that was how he passed away.
They do have a language for that. It's called a shared death experience. And I've talked with some near-death experiencers who've actually been through that kind of a stage, their own unique perspective with whoever it was that was transitioning, usually a close relative, sister, brother, spouse. And it's life-changing. In this chapter, you also give a practice. I could see peace instead of this, because some of these scenes you're describing, being in the room when there's all sorts of trauma and blood and gore, and then having that transition where there's this transcendent experience that you actually became part of, there's no language that can share how amazing that is, but it is life-changing.
Yeah, it certainly was. I had never experienced anything like that up until that point. And even talking about it right now, it doesn't do justice. It's this feeling of, I don't know how to express it. It's like when you go into the ocean, if you swim out into the Pacific Ocean, I'm in California, so that's what I'm thinking. And you get momentarily, you get a sense of how deep the ocean is. And it kind of scares you a little bit because it's not like a swimming pool where you know that the floor is like three feet below me. It's like you suddenly, briefly touch the vastness. And it is beyond comprehension. That's kind of what I felt. I had never heard that term shared death experience until I started to have these conversations with people. But I agree with you. I think that's what it was.
And the thing about that, too, though, is that you don't have to be a medium. You don't have to have any special skill. You just have to be human, because these things happen. And we're basically hardwired for this kind of stuff. We just don't address it. And there are no real classes from the time you're a kid, unless you have it in your family in that background. There isn't an instruction that says this is how you do it, basically because it's different for every single person. Each person is unique. And the fact that you had it as in the position you're in, I think it's wonderful, because then you're able to be present for other people. And the fact that you have also the education, the background with all the different religions and different lifestyles of spirit, the way that people connect, then you can be present for somebody in a way that others can't, who if they're, you know, one denomination their entire life and they don't see the broad spectrum of how we connect with spirit, doesn't mean that they're in the wrong place. It just means that it's so wonderful to have someone with your background who can step forward and meet them on an equal plane. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I'm so grateful. None of this, I guess on a conscious level, was planned. I'm honestly grateful to my parents for the exposure they gave me and for my upbringing. But yeah, you're right. It sort of creates a deep level of acceptance and respect for every path there is out there. I like to say sometimes there are as many paths to God as there are humans. It's just everyone's unique. We all have our own unique path to source.
You use a lot of Shakespeare in here, okay? And okay. Was there a reason you chose Shakespeare?
Gosh, I love him so. I just love Shakespeare so much. He captures what I feel in such a poetic way. I mean, there's just so many ways that he expresses this. There's this one phrase I definitely quoted it, where he talks about the cloud-capped towers and the solemn temples, and it will leave not a rack behind. In that basic short poem, he says everything we see is just like a vision, and it dissolves into thin air. And I love that expression, because when I'm, you know, sitting and meditating and I face the heaviness of regret, or the burden of judgment, judging others, or just the suffocation of anger and how it just clouds your vision. When I face that and I'm able to heal it, it feels like it's evaporating into thin air. And then I just wonder about all these problems we face that seem so real. When the work is done, when healing is done, they do become like thin air, like visions, as Shakespeare says. And the way he talks about it matches my experience of what healing feels like. That's why I use him.
Going into the deathbed exercise step, was this what you trained for when you were in your teens? Because I'm thinking Wednesday yeah. Addams might be the perfect the perfect comparison for this one.
Yeah, it's different though. I'm glad you mentioned this. If you just say nothing's real, everyone's going to die, nothing matters, that leads to depression. In fact, that's Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus. They are famous existentialists that arrived to this conclusion that nothing matters here. And I don't know if this was Sartre or Camus that said this, but they said basically the only question there is to ask is whether or not to kill yourself. And that is deeply morbid, and I don't agree with that. Yeah. That's not the only question. But if you stop there, if your focus on mortality stops there, then of course it's morbid. But the contemplation of mortality is deeply spiritual and can create genuine transformation if it leads you to the realization that you are not this body. You are that which is eternal. You are the essence of love itself, and it cannot be touched by anything in this world. It cannot be touched by thought, by emotion, by feeling, by regret and resentment and fear. None of those things can touch your eternal nature, and that's the benefit of contemplating mortality, because it will guide you to the truth of who you are.
In my view, it gives you permission to breathe. It's just like, oh, I can relax. Okay, what's here? And so now it becomes more of an adventure and more interesting and more, I'm just more curious about what all's really going on, because yeah, I'm going to have the body for a while and I'm going to lose it eventually, but what can I do while I'm here? And what else is there to learn, to know? You know, how many ways can I see things differently? To me, it just opens up a whole new vista of things that are possible. And that's what I see. Yeah. Even when you are speaking the language and saying the only choice is, and that's it, I'm not saying it, I'm not going to say it out loud, I feel my body just kind of deflate like a tire. It goes flat.
Yeah.
But when I feel the release of, everybody dies. My pets die. It's excruciatingly painful to lose them.
Yeah.
And to lose a person. It's the pain is, and yet when it finally lifts and when you're finally able to say, I know that they are okay. And that I've experienced pets and knowing they're okay and having them be a ghost and all that. And it's not the same as a body, but it's a relief and it's a release and it's a renewal. Of, wow, I'm going to do that too. Oh, that's fascinating. Okay. And when you meet somebody who's deceased and they let you know that they're not dead and they're still around, it's mind blowing the first time. Eventually it gets like, okay, guys, give me a break. But that thing is, it's a release. And for me, it's like, okay, I can get on with living. I can relax. I can breathe. I'm free. But I never looked at it like that until I realized how my body changed when I was around that kind of enthusiasm, that kind of joie de vivre life of, wow, look what's here. It's just amazing.
Yeah. You're so right. There's something that happens when you discover your essence and your essence as unconditional love, as pure presence, pure awareness that cannot be affected by anything in this world, there's a lightness of being that comes. It's like the feeling, well, first of all, we do so much in our lives in order to be loved, in order to be respected. We chase after things because deep down inside, there's a worry that we don't deserve to be loved. And we live our lives trying to please people. And maybe it shows up differently for different people. But then when you come to a place, when you deeply, deeply know without a shadow of doubt that you are eternally loved and that you deserve to be loved and you are loved, it's almost like the gates are open. You suddenly feel, I can do anything because I'm free now. I don't need to worry about whether I am loved. I know I am. And there's a freedom of expression. And now you show up to life and to every relationship you're in with, as you said, with a joie de vivre, with an enthusiasm to live life fully and to be the purest expression of who you are, because there's no more worry anymore that you aren't loved. You know you're loved. That changes everything.
There's another story you have in here, and this is basically, I am never upset for the reason I think. And talking about the family in conjunction with this particular person. We get caught up, the mind game of what you're talking about, all the things we try to do to be loved, to be appreciated, to be respected, to be valued, all of those things that really, in the end, it's like, okay, I'm so tired. It never turns out the way you expect. Sometimes it's worse. Often it's better. And you can't illustrate that. You can't compare it to anybody else's reality. But it sure makes your own space easier to reconcile. And you're talking about, I think this is when he gets to go home and rallies and recovers. And there's this wonderful enthusiasm around that. That's a good story to share.
Oh man, that was one of the hardest experiences for me to go through. I still have emotions around it. Actually, I remember I had to write and rewrite and rewrite that particular passage because I kept crying. I kept tearing up when I wrote it, and I still feel a tightness around my heart, which tells me I have more healing to do around it. But this story is a young boy who had a very severe genetic disorder, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. Basically, his muscles are very, very weak, and he was sort of born much shorter than usual because his muscles didn't grow with his bones. He had a lot of deformities, and one of the challenges that he had to compete with was his muscles of his diaphragm weren't strong enough to help him cough, so he would frequently come back in with pneumonias. the average lifespan for a boy with this condition is early 20s, between 20 and 24. And he, I think, was 21 or 22 at that point. I forget exactly. So he was right there. And his mom knew that any day could be his last. And I think he knew too. He had brothers that had this condition. I had two brothers with this condition. And it's just so, so sad, the whole family dealing with it. This was a family that stared at death in the face daily. That alone made me and others respect them so much. And respect his mom. God bless her soul. Oh my gosh. Can you imagine being a mother with three children that you knew were going to die before you died, essentially? Like, I don't know, like, what kind of courage is needed for that kind of life? And to top it off, her, as soon as the father heard that his children had this deformity, he left her. He left the family and he bounced.
Yeah.
That's painful to not have that kind of support and to have to deal with the anger and try to heal that anger. Whew, it was a heaviness that they went through. And despite all of that, they were one of the happiest families in the ICU, genuinely appreciative of the nurses, cracking jokes, smiling. I remember this young kid, he would always just want to watch the news. There's this one particular news anchor that he really enjoyed. I'm like, wow, this kid's so, so interesting. Like, he's got interests and hobbies, and he was getting better. We were able to extubate him off of life support, and the antibiotics did their trick. As you said, he was rallying and seemed like he recovered from the pneumonia. He got strong enough where he was able to work with physical therapy and move, and he graduated from the ICU. We said, okay, you know, you are, I made his name Aaron. For the record, every name in the book, I changed from the real name just to respect privacy. But so Aaron graduated essentially from the ICU, and it was like, we all fell in love with him. He always smiled when we visited him. He was grateful and thankful. And I remember saying in the book, I don't know what saints look like, but he seems like he fits the bill. Like something, some kind of light was exuding from him. I remember walking into his room on many occasions and I just didn't want to leave. There was a peace in his room. It's like the lights were on much higher than the rest of the hospital. Like something was happening with the electricity. I don't know. Or maybe it was just my own sense that it was brighter in his room. There was something special about that soul. I don't know what it is, but I felt it. And we all felt it. So when he was leaving, I remember we were wheeling him out of the ICU with his mom, and we all stopped what we were doing and we came out and we started clapping. It was like a hero's parade, you know, when they come back from the war and everyone starts clapping. We kind of felt like that about him, like the hero was a hero, and here he had overcome the pneumonia and he's going back home a hero. That's what we felt. And so that evening, it just made the news that I got all the more painful. But that evening I got a phone call. I had worked a day shift and I went home, and it was a nighttime ICU provider that called me to let me know that they received a report from police, who said a 911 call had been made from his house, and that he basically was having dinner and just collapsed. He just suddenly collapsed. His mom was in another room, heard the collapse and rushed, called 911, and 911 called our hospital to prep an emergency bay room because they would be coming in hot. But unfortunately, he passed away as they were doing resuscitative efforts, and they couldn't get him back. And I know that mom and I know that kid, and I cannot imagine the grief she went through to literally bring him back from the hospital, to have overcome the challenge of the pneumonia, just to have him die right there in the living room. It fills me with such pain and compassion for her, because I know she's going to have to deal with that with her two other sons as well. So I cried that night.
There's a different way of looking at it, though. He went home.
Yeah.
He went home.
Yeah.
And that, to me, it's like he rallied so he didn't have to die in the hospital. And that's not saying that is an awful thing, but in the way he chose to do it, he took that energy, that light you're talking about, and he gave that light back to his family and said goodbye. So to me, it's like, it's beautiful. And I can, I mean, it's excruciating because of the scenario and the whole situation with the family. But as a soul, for him to be able to do that, to recover, to rally, to say goodbye, to cheer, to that buoyancy that comes with that, and then to go home and say, okay, I'm sorry, but I'm leaving you in the light. And I think that's just magnificent. So I'm glad you, I hear your angst, but I'm glad you shared this story because it's just another perspective of how we check out in a neat, positive, illuminating way.
Yeah. And I want to share that night when I heard, I immediately sat up in bed because I was getting ready to sleep. I just sat up in bed. I closed my eyes and I immediately sent him love. I immediately sent him love. I sent him gratitude. And I don't know, you know, who am I to recommend what to do, but I feel like there is a deep connection that we have each other that transcends the veil of death. Like I said, love does not know death. And so I sent him love. I sent him gratitude. And I had this really fascinating experience where if only you could have seen his face, he had the most interesting eyes. They were brilliant and bright with really long eyelashes. And I remember meditating and sending him love and genuinely going into my heart to create a sense of freedom and letting him know he is free and he is loved and he is, I'm grateful for him. And as I was doing that, I saw his eyes appear in my mental vision, my third eye, if you will, sort of just coming right there at me and beaming love right back at me. And I felt a very strong connection with him, almost as if he was saying, I love you too. And I'm grateful for what you did for me too. It was this really precious moment that evening. And when I was thinking of him and I just sent him all my love. And yes, it was painful, but I feel like it is possible in those moments of pain to still send love and gratitude.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And they hear it, they feel it, they sense it. It's again, the body is just the vessel. It's our little taxi that we roam around in while we're here. And, yeah. You know, we make memories and then we go home and talk about it and laugh about it and cry about it and go, oh, wow. And then back for more. In the fall, a relative transitioned. And I was there during the time the family, friends were gathered around this, like one of the last days of his life that he was in. He was in a hospital bed and they're all gathered working on a vehicle, one of the vehicles. He loved cars. I mean, if he could be a car, he would be a car. And he was still concerned at the end of where the cars were going to be. The room was buoyant. And it was so interesting because there's another person who was a psychic. We both had that same word, buoyant. And as he was going, I knew that he was conscious and in between. So there physically and also there in essence, spirit beside the body. And so I told him, if there's anything I can do, please let me know. And thinking that he would tell my brother and that that would work that way. I knew when he transitioned, I knew that he had left. And because I was sending light and sending love. And they said, well, he's transitioned. Well, is the body still there? I asked just to kind of get an idea what was going on. Then later that day, I had that sense. And he said, tell my brother, tell him that I'm there when he comes home. And I'm like, wait, because I'm still physical and I still have to deal with people maybe being shocked or not ready to hear something like that, even though he is open. And at the same time, though, as I'm hesitating, thinking, how am I going to finesse this? He says, you said you would help. And I'm like, yes, I did. Okay. I didn't know it would be like this. So I waited till my brother could go home to the house without me projecting anything so he could have his experience. So when I did call and talk to him, the first thing he said, well, the house doesn't feel empty. He's still here. And then I could tell him what I was supposed to say. So they are present and they are with us. Even if we don't see them, if they don't have a body, that essence is so incredibly present and stronger than when we are in a physical form. And that's my experience. I just wanted to add that so that if someone is listening and curious and wondering about that ability for someone to be aware of your presence, even though you cannot speak to them, and they may not be able to speak or hear you with their physical body, they are still a part of this reality and present as they're continuing to do their earth walk until they transition. That was my experience when he said, but you said you'd help. I'm like, okay.
Yeah,
I did make an appointment. I did. Yeah, it's just that thing of you don't want to offend somebody. You don't want to interfere. You don't want to impose. I didn't want to in some way predisposition this to something happening before he had his own experience and then could say authentically, he's here. He's here. He isn't gone. The house is full. It feels, so that's another reality.
That's a great point. I'm so glad you shared that. Very true. Very true.
Your book is for anyone who is experiencing a transition or experiencing a previous loss and just needing some kind of comfort, information, awareness. Love does not know death. It certainly doesn't. And that's a great title.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that, Wendy. It's been such a pleasure to share these stories with you and dive deep into this. It's absolutely a joy.
Well, you also have a podcast. So let's talk about that too, because there are people who might have just gotten a little tip of the iceberg here. And then your podcast is it Letters to the Sky?
I do have a podcast with my co-host, Stephen Downs. It's called Letters to the Sky. We talk about spirituality and enlightenment and really the practical aspects of growing, of developing, of playing this game of spiritual awakening. If you are interested in reading some more of my work, I have a Substack. It's adamrisby.substack.com. It's called Adventures in Kindness. And essentially, it's about the lessons I learned in the hospital, the way that patients show up, all the miracles that happen on a day-to-day basis in the hospital and in medicine. And I am hoping to have some more deep dive articles where I explore the comparative religion angle as well. So if you're interested, you can follow me there.
You say, and you no training, no background, but to me, you are a very spiritually aware person. Is there anything during this death and dying transition process that really just shocked you completely that you were able to, aside from the shared death experience, that you were able to bridge that gap and to really be aware?
One of the biggest lessons of all of this that I'm still learning is the importance of self-awareness. I have become so much more aware of my own internal state, of the inner landscape of thoughts and emotions, of just this, the raw, naked awareness of the light of awareness. I like to say that as well. The light of awareness that is the ground of experience itself has become so clear to me. And there's something that happens when there's a felt sense of moment-to-moment presence, just being here in the now, not the future, not the past. There is only this. That sort of grounded presence has become more and more of my daily reality. And the other thing that has become an accepted part of my reality is I feel like my father passed away. I feel like I'm literally arm's reach away from him in my mind. And I feel like people who pay attention to that inner world more often, they will feel that as well too. When your loved one passes away, it's almost like they're freed from the limitations of the body. They are instantly reachable by thought, by emotion, by feeling. You can feel them. I can feel my father just by thinking about him. He comes to me very vividly in dreams. It's almost like the means of communication goes from a 56K dial-up modem to lightning fast fiber optic speed, right? It's like, and that domain and the field of communication just opens wide if we recognize it as such. That's been another thing that I've learned.
Yeah. The timing for this conversation is absolutely perfect. Right place, right time, and right information. It's that thing of being grounded, and all of a sudden, doors open, minds open, reality shifts.
Yeah, well said. Yes, thank you, Wendy. I couldn't agree more.
I love what you've done with the book, and I hope it reaches a lot of people. And I'll do what I can to at least, you know, send it on its way, and you just keep being you.
Thank you, Wendy. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this. It's been such a joy talking to you. There's this quote in the tail end of A Course in Miracles that says, a universal theology is impossible. But a universal experience is not only possible, but necessary.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses, plus free delivery when you add a base. Ends Monday. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.